Hello and welcome to the IEA channel with me, Emma Rebel, Head of Communications at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Don't forget to sign up to our IEA daily newsletter to get all the news, views and reports direct to your inbox, and subscribe to our YouTube channel to never miss an episode of our new digital programme. With Britain in lockdown, the government has been racing to find ways to ease restrictions without putting public safety at risk. One solution is a contract tracing app that can enable digital contract tracing on a large scale using Bluetooth. One such app is under development by NHSX with researchers from Oxford University. Another such app is being developed through tech giants Apple and Google, tweaking their smartphone operating systems to help digital contract tracing. But the UK is an outlier in rejecting this approach. So is Britain sleepwalking into another coronavirus blunder by failing to listen to global consensus and expert analysis by going its own way? Does NHSX, as my colleague Christopher Snowden has suggested, have all the hallmarks of another government IT failure? I'm joined today by Victoria Hewson, Head of Regulatory Affairs at the Institute of Economic Affairs, and Jim Killick, who's the Executive Director of the Open Rights Group. Good morning to you both. Before we get into the practicalities of different versions of contract tracing apps, can I just ask you both if you agree with the idea at all? I mean, there are significant civil liberties implications in contract tracing. Jim, we'll start with you.
Well, I think it's reasonable to propose it. What's actually really difficult to know is whether it'll work and how well it'll work, because this is, you know, it's measuring proximity, not risk. It's kind of using signal strength of Bluetooth to have a guess how close you were standing to somebody and for how long. And that, you know, it doesn't tell you whether they were inside or outside, doesn't tell you whether the wind was blowing, doesn't tell you if the person was coughing at you or wearing a face mask. I mean, so the result is it's just having a guess at whether maybe there was some risk. And I think within that, it's very likely that the result is people get notified of many, many more risks or risk events than really are very likely to translate into actual transmission. And that it also kind of needs to work that way, because it's no good telling people of just the most important risks. You know, that probably isn't enough, because those you probably already know about. So, you know, like the person you live with or something like that. So I think that's going to be a really big issue. You know, how useful is this? And that's really something we don't know yet.
Victoria, what do you think?
I think that's right. And that's one of the key points, is that the kinds of solutions that are being proposed are really quite intrusive. Even the decentralized Google, Apple solution that we'll come on to is quite intrusive in terms of the information that it will gather and what enable people to work out. And so for those kinds of intrusions into people's privacy and the uses of those information, of that information, to be worthwhile, you've got to be really sure that there's an overwhelming public interest in it, and that it will actually achieve the objectives, and that there is no other less intrusive way of achieving this overriding public health objective. And I'm afraid I would probably say that, from what I've seen before and for all the reasons that Jim just described, I'm not convinced that these contact tracing apps really do meet those criteria. It's a very high bar for me. If there was a technology solution that would enable us to cure the virus, stamp it out and get back to normal, I'm not a Luddite, I would definitely embrace that, but you would have to be very, very sure that it would work, and that there was no other less privacy violating way of achieving it.
I mean, one of the other reasons that we're not sure it could work is that the government has suggested that they'd need 60% of the population to download it to have enough coverage to make it successful, but only 50% of Brits say they would download it. So, I mean, that's close, but it's not quite close enough. Also, 90% of Britons have said they don't want lockdown measures to be eased because they're so worried about, you know, catching the virus and the health impacts. So they're quite happy to just stay at home. So actually, if we have this app and 50% of people do download it, are the only people you're going to be picking up in Bluetooth range just your neighbours? And if they're the other side of the wall, you probably haven't coronavirus from them anyway? You know, is this really going to be useful?
Well, I think where it becomes useful is late on, or potentially useful, right? So if you've got a low number of people who are infected and causing risk, and therefore a small number of people get notified, then I think at that point, you know, because there is no lockdown and you do need some ways of picking up some of these risk or proximity events, then yeah, I mean, at that point that the app can have a contribution. The problem though is at that point, people won't feel as motivated necessarily to be using an app or managing their risk, because they'll feel it's mostly gone away potentially. Certainly the urgency is much lower. So you need a solution where people have kind of just do it. And I think that's where the Apple Google system has a significant edge, because the way that is going to work is people will be asked to opt into proximity recording when they update their operating systems. So the system, the app, it's, you won't need to download apps or whatever. They'll just, your phone will ask you. And that means I think you'll get a lot more people joining those systems. Whereas the government has got to kind of persuade everybody individually to go out there and download the app and keep the app on and et cetera, et cetera. And it's just a lot more barriers to high take up.
I mean, Victoria, Jim's touched on the different types of apps, but for listeners who've got a kind of peripheral understanding of contract tracing apps, can you give us, explain the difference between the two different types, which are the centralised and the decentralised?
I will try my best.
Thank you.
So basically, the centralised app, which is what the NHSX app, the centralised model that the NHSX app uses, it is a way in which users will download the app onto their device, and then your device will then use Bluetooth to talk to everyone else's device who also has the app downloaded. And it will build up a record of all of the devices that you've been in proximity with. And then if you feel some symptoms, you start coughing and get a temperature, you then go into the app and register your symptoms, and then upload all of the contacts that you've made through Bluetooth into the NHS's central server. And then the NHS deploys what they're calling highly sophisticated risk analysis to determine whether these contacts were sufficiently proximate for a sufficient amount of time, and deploys various other risk calculations to decide whether to issue an alert to all of those contacts. So it's all done through the intermediary of a central server. And the Google Apple system, which isn't an app, it's just a sort of set of infrastructure that people can use to make apps work through, is a way in which users, again, you download an app, so a health authority devises an app that will work through this Google Apple API, and then in a very similar way, your device will talk to other people's devices who've got the app, but instead of the information being shared with this centralized server operated by the app provider, your device contacts never get shared with the central authority. What happens is all of the other, if you get symptoms, or more likely in the case of the centralized apps, you get a test and you've tested positive, you upload your test result to the central server, and then all of your contacts, their devices periodically check in with the central server to see if there is a match. And if there is, the match is done on your device, not on the central server. So the central authority never knows who's been in contact with whom, which for privacy reasons is highly preferable. However, for the other reasons that one, you know, the in the interests of the app provider and the health authority, there are significant downsides from that because they miss out on a whole extra rich layer of information about who's been in contact with whom and in which broad locations. So there's a lot of research and epidemiological data that health authorities miss out on by pursuing a decentralized solution. And so that's why I've said in my blog, a lot of the criticism of the NHSX app, I think, has been slightly unfair because they haven't just gone off on a frolic of their own because they feel like it and they want to be bloody-minded British exceptionalists. They actually had some quite plausible reasons for wanting to have this information centrally available for research and resource planning. It's just that it does involve even greater levels of privacy trade-offs and therefore requires a lot more work to make it both legal and, as you alluded to before, appealing to people to actually use it if they think that there's all of this extra surveillance going to be happening on them.
It seems quite unusual to me, at least, that we've, in this conversation, Apple and Google are the ones on the side of privacy. That's not something you generally think of large tech giants. We tend to be quite suspicious about the level of data we're sharing with them. Jim, what do you think about the pros and cons of each different style of device or app, I suppose?
So I think, I mean, first thing, let's just say, why would Google suddenly want you to have less data shared? And I think there are two reasons. One is that they need everyone to have confidence in the mobile phone infrastructure and in their companies and everything else. And in general, private companies, therefore, are a lot more comfortable with you sharing data with them than with the outside world. So whenever governments come along and ask for data, they start getting worried because their business model, which relies on the use of a lot of data, starts feeling more creepy because it's being used in ways that you didn't really agree to and didn't really expect. So that there's a simple business reason. And then there's a wider political reason, which is, you know, if you provide this capacity to one government, you provide it to all. So very quickly, you know, the apparently reasonable thing that the British government was doing is being replicated by Turkey, by India and by China. They're all using the same system, but the things they're doing with this system look a lot less reasonable and, you know, frankly, probably a pretty awful. And that puts them in a really difficult position. They can't be supporting things which are fundamentally, you know, removing people's liberties, abusing people, putting them at real physical risks. They can't be doing those things. So by devising a system where the matching is done on your phone, as opposed to by the central government, they remove most of those really tangible physical risks, not all of them, but most of them. And I think that's the real driver here. I mean, they just don't want to be in a situation where, you know, in 6 months' time, they're being told that their app has been used to arrest people, to get people beat up, to be used for political, you know, to eliminate political opponents or jail them or whatever else. I mean, all of these things could happen as a result of centralized systems. Of course, that's not what the NHS is trying to do, but the same technology could be employed in those kinds of ways elsewhere. So I think that's their big motivation.
Victoria, if the UK does go down the centralised approach with the NHS Act, who's responsible for safeguarding our privacy? Can we trust that concerns of civil liberties will be heard and acted on if the NHS develops its own app separate from Apple and Google?
Yeah, so that's a really important question. Obviously, whatever the NHS develops needs to, first of all, comply with law. And in our case, that's the Data Protection Act and the GDPR and other associated bits of regulation as well around e-privacy. And it does sound like the developers are working quite hard on this, although we haven't really seen much detail from them other than various assurances that they are working on a data protection impact assessment, which is a necessary regulatory step that they have to take to ensure that they are complying with law and that they are protecting people's privacy and securing their data to the greatest possible extent. And the information commissioner, who's broadly responsible for overseeing this compliance, has been involved in working with the NHSX team in working through these things. Now, as I point out again in my blog, this is a bit of an awkward situation, as this was also pointed out by MPs on the Human Rights Committee, who were taking evidence both from the chief executive of NHSX and from the information commissioner herself about this. And some of the MPs were sort of exploring this question with the information commissioner, Elizabeth Denham. How can you be both working with NHSX on this and, you know, advising them on it, and therefore really becoming, at least to some degree, presumably a bit invested in it, and then subsequently responsible for monitoring their compliance and enforcing people's complaints about it? Is that not a bit like marking your own homework? And I think that is quite a valid concern. It's also interesting that the information commissioner has signaled in something she'd written recently, a couple of weeks ago, on her blog, that as a regulator, they were considering the proportionality of all of these uses of personal data in the fight against COVID-19. But she was cognizant that as a society, we have accepted restrictions on our liberty in the interest of public health. And yeah, I really was quite disconcerted by that, because I'm not sure it's her place to determine what society has accepted. And I also found it quite ironic that this kind of quite serious trade-off that she has decided that people are willing to make isn't a trade-off that she has particularly shown herself, or information commissioners have particularly shown themselves willing to make on economic matters, for example, where you know, there is a huge social interest in innovation and e-commerce and things in social media. But really, from my experience in practice and in research, the information commissioner has never really been that keen to make those kinds of trade-offs of people's economic interests in an innovative tech sector versus privacy concerns. So I found that a little bit alarming.
Jim, do you want to come back on Victoria's views about the regulator? Do you agree, disagree?
Well, I think there's a few caveats. The first is that they are, unfortunately, from my point of view at least, very sensitive to economic arguments sometimes. I think probably the point is that they need to be a little bit more careful about when and where they make these balances. But in relation to the online advertising industry, for instance, we made a complaint to them a year ago, and they've done absolutely nothing. And the reason is they're afraid of the economic consequences of acting. So I think what you're seeing here is a regulator that is kind of playing fast and loose, sometimes doing it one way, sometimes not. It needs to regulate against the laws. And if the laws don't work for whatever reason, then if they don't take sufficient regard of the size of businesses, of industries, what the effects are exactly, that needs changing. In terms of what they're doing with the app, I think what's happening there is that, the thing to bear in mind is they're not the end of this, any process, right? They are not actually the lawmakers. So if they do have a role advising governments prior to making regulatory judgments, they have to remember all the time they could end up in court over these decisions. Therefore, they have to make decisions very carefully. And also the result of that is that they never actually say this is what is necessary. They say this is our advice and these are the things you must address. And they do it that way because they know full well they'll end up being asked, was this right or wrong? And they can't really know until they poke at it for a very, very long time indeed. And of course, that actually causes huge frustration to people, businesses and others, because they feel like the ICO never gives them clarity on things, because essentially it can't, because before it's you know, given that quasi-judicial role. So, you know, regulators are imperfect things. The question is how and what kind of regulation you want. The IEA and ourselves, we might take slightly different views about that. But the really critical thing, I would say, is that regulators need to be consistent and they need to be effective and resourced. And at the moment, I think there are questions on all of those for the ICO.
Do we know, do we have any early indications of how the UK government might enforce use of this app? So, I mean, some other countries have suggested that if you don't have this app, you won't be allowed on public transport. You may not, some offices or workplaces may say, you know, if we can't check the app and see you haven't been in contact with anyone with coronavirus, you can't come to work today. Is it a scare story to suggest things like that might be implemented in the UK, or have the government said, no, under no circumstances, we won't be doing this?
So doesn't matter what they say, does it? What have they, what can they do? Have they legislated?
Yeah, I think that's it. So at present, they've said, or at least the app developers have said, that it will be voluntary and that you can delete it at any time. And they may well think that now, but as Jim says, as the public appetite for more and more to be done to try and solve this situation we're in, who knows? And frankly, some of the regulations that have been brought in under the coronavirus banner have been, you know, put through very, very quickly and with very little scrutiny. So who knows might what they might feel able to push through. Some countries, I think India, I was just reading, have made downloading this app mandatory, punishable by a criminal penalty if you fail to download it. And even, frankly, even if it's not made mandatory by law, you can easily see how it would become a social expectation. Employers might require it to manage, help manage their risk of having employees on their premises. You know, shops, restaurants, if they're ever allowed to open again, might start to require it. So there's a whole extra level here of concerns, which I have to say, for me, this is almost more of a concern than the data gathering aspect of it, because it becomes a tool for neighbors to start spying on each other and judging each other if you haven't got the app or if you haven't done the right thing in response to advice that the app has alerted you to. So there's huge problems with this. And I'm not sure that any of these things really, there's been a lot of discussion about the workings of the app, but I don't think I've seen, for my liking, I haven't seen enough debate and analysis about these second order effects of how it will be used in society.
Yeah, once this door is open, it's very hard to work out how, you know, how you can close it again. The UK is conducting a trial on the Isle of Wight to sort of test and see how it works and hopefully iron some of the kinks out. It's still very early days, but have we got any feedback from that? Are there any red flags that have jumped up going, oh, we desperately need to fix this, for example?
Well, I think we've heard little bits. You know, we don't really know until we get results from a trial. Hopefully the government will produce results on exactly what's happened and explain. But I think, you know, actually the trial isn't going to answer this main question, which is about national take up, about how easy it is for people to join the system. It also, I think the other thing we haven't touched on is what happens across borders. And it's pretty much impossible to make the centralized and decentralized systems talk to each other. And I think this is a bit where, you know, there is some British exceptionalism going on. It might not have been by design, but it has become, you know, the effect. And, you know, this app will not talk to the island, app in the Republic of Ireland. So you're going to have a digital border effectively between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland where the apps cannot talk to each other, and it's therefore more or less impossible to trace risks in those border areas because people are not sharing that contact information. And similarly, you know, when international travel eases up over time, what happens then? If the systems are very different as they are between Germany and the UK, that's going to make that sort of risk tracing across that set of borders harder as well. And I think we can also expect the United States to mostly adopt an Apple, Google type system rather than centralized systems, not least because of the ease of deployment at this stage. So, you know, it's going to be a bit of a curious situation where perhaps France, perhaps the UK can do this, but, you know, it doesn't work with the rest of Europe and the US.
Yeah, I think the numbers in the Isle of Wight haven't been... It hasn't been a complete stampede on the island to adopt it. I think the numbers I saw in the papers yesterday was about 40% of the population of the Isle of Wight have downloaded the app. But in terms of the population of sort of eligible people who have a smartphone, it's closer to 80%, which is probably there or thereabouts of what the developers would be looking for. In terms of how it's been working, there's again mixed accounts. Some people are saying the technical flaws with keeping Bluetooth working in the background haven't really quite been working, which for me, that's the main thing that could be the make or break of the app as far as the wider deployment goes, because if it's simply physically will not work because of the limitations of the Apple and Google operating systems, then that really has to be the end of it. In the Irish border situation is an interesting one, because I think through the discussions about the trade border on the island of Ireland, it became very clear, or certainly very strongly argued, that many people in the border communities of a nationalist persuasion weren't even willing to have their movement of goods and their trade tracked by the British government. So the idea that these people are going to download an app that's going to record their health data and that of everyone who they've been in proximity with is probably not going to fly. So I'm not sure whether this conflict of the apps is going to be that much of a problem in practice, because I suspect these people just wouldn't download the British one anyway. But it's, you know, it is a very good illustration of the interoperability problem amongst many others that these apps have. I mean, I would just end as well by saying, really harking back to some of the original points about whether these apps are really going to get us out of the hole that we're in. Over the weekend, it was reported that in South Korea, which is very much held up as the shining example of how to use technology and contact tracing to suppress the virus, they have basically closed down all the pubs and bars in Seoul, because contact tracing identified that one person was out on a night out in Seoul and gave rise to several hundred cases. So they've closed down the whole of the entertainment sector in Seoul again. So for me, that illustrates that even if you can get really, really strict contact tracing with a very wide uptake, and they have even more draconian measures than just an app in South Korea, that hasn't unfortunately allowed them to get back to a normal life. So that might also deter people from getting on board with this app.
Yeah. So I think two things I'd say on that. One is, you know, you're right to say that some communities are just going to be too distrusting of this app, and that could apply to quite a few communities. But yeah, the fact is that the decentralized system probably does have enough privacy for those groups to engage with it if they want. So it at least gives people a flying chance of being able to persuade some of those, or at least more of those people to pick up the app. I mean, other groups might include, for instance, migrants. And of course, you know, some of those groups like migrants, use of smartphones is actually pretty high. So yeah, it could be quite a useful thing, but they're not necessarily going to trust the Home Office with this data. And there doesn't seem to be a legal barrier to stop the Home Office from acquiring it. So, you know, there's kind of things like that, which I think are interesting about how this plays out over time, because, you know, we do want widespread adoption if possible. The other point I was going to make is about the research, which we talked about earlier, which was just, you know, can you in a decentralized system get the data for all the, you know, understanding the outbreak, where it's happening, what the sort of levels of contacts are, and so on. And there are, you know, there are some ways of doing at least some of this, maybe not absolutely everything, but it just requires a bit more thought in a decentralized system, because you need to identify what information you really need and then ask for it. And of course, it is possible for people to, for instance, volunteer more information in the process, you know, by consent. So I think the research question is not quite as binary as the NHS have made it out to be. It is possible to do these things. It just requires more planning and forethought, whereas in a centralized system, all the data's there. So you sort of use it perhaps a little bit more freely. And then I guess the other question with this is this really a research tool, or is it a proximity recording tool? And while the NHS might want it for research purposes, if that actually, again, reduces take up because people are worried about how the NHS handles data, whether they'll use it for research, whether this will get into the hands of, you know, some of the companies that are contracted to the NHS at the moment and so on, you reduce take up. So, and therefore efficacy. So I think the interesting things are, are really around the tensions between take up producing efficacy and the desire of the NHS and others for all of this information. So, you know, that's what I see. I think we won't know really until several governments have tried it.
It's very difficult to draw this conversation to a close because there are just so many things that we don't know, and there's a lot of wait and see, and we don't quite know yet. So I suspect we may well come back to this in a couple of weeks and may well have the same conversation again. But Jim and Victoria, thank you very much for joining me today. Don't forget, if you want to access all of the IEA's content, you can subscribe to our podcasts on Podbean, Apple or Spotify, and our videos on our YouTube channel, IEA London. You can also subscribe to our IEA daily and Sunday newsletters if you visit the IEA website. Thank you very much for listening.